Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on EU developments, enforcement, legislation and guidance, including e-privacy, by Julian Milford. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference at the Kelvin Theatre, IET London Savoy Place. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
There's far too much to talk about, I'm afraid, under this topic, so I'm going to ruthlessly cull the bits that I address orally, and I'm sorry if that misses out anything that anyone's particularly interested in, but I hope it's all there on the slides. What I'm going to do is to cover five topics, not all of which I can actually speak about, but one is enforcement action by national authorities. The second is the right to be forgotten. Then third, I'm going to be addressing e-privacy, the e-privacy regulation and various decisions in the court and by the Advocate General. Then Schrems 2 and the really important decision of the Advocate General in that case. And finally, and I'm sorry, I don't think I will actually be able to get to speak about it, there's video surveillance and facial recognition at the end of these slides. But let me start first of all with GDPR breaches. And just for interest, I've set out a selection of the big fines for recent data breaches imposed across the EU. And it's interesting that the two biggest, at least prospectively, although they haven't been confirmed yet, are from the Information Commissioner here. That is the British Airways data breach, where roughly 500,000 customers had their credit card details stolen. And the second is Marriott, where hackers took the details of about 339 million guests. There's then a decision of CNIL, the French regulator, about Google's use of personalized ads, which at the time was a pretty eye-catching fine, 50 million euros, and a selection of decisions from other countries, Italy, Austria, Germany. It's a mixed picture. The most eye-catching fines, as I say, have not yet been confirmed, and there's nothing at all approaching the 5 billion Facebook fine in the US from the Federal Trade Commission. But perhaps more importantly, there are problems of consistency across EU member states. In principle, the European Data Protection Board has the power to issue consistency guidelines under Article 70, but none have yet been issued, and there's no indication as to when they may be issued. And I was just having a look at recent consistency decisions, and I saw that the Polish regulator had imposed a fine of 500,000 euros, roughly, on a company that had had the details of 2.2 million customers, sensitive details of 2.2 million customers stolen. And even without knowing the precise details of that breach, and you compare it to the prospective fine for British Airways, and you have to say there's at least a question to be asked as to how different national authorities are responding to data breaches that may, in some senses, be comparable. Of course, the other really important point to make about the size of these fines is that in the end, that may not be the most important thing for the data controller, because if, as a claimant, you can simply cut and paste the findings of your national regulatory authority into your civil claim, then the size of the fine may be dwarfed by prospective civil liability. That's part of the mixed picture. Another part of the mixed picture is the particular problems of policing big tech. And that's in a context where the two countries that are most directly responsible for this, which is Ireland and Luxembourg, have basically most of the big US firms with their main EU headquarters in them. So Ireland has got Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Twitter, etc. Luxembourg has got Amazon, but it's also got eBay and PayPal. And if one asks a rhetorical question. Are small nations with a mix of business-friendly regulation and low corporate tax and with rather limited funds available to data protection authorities necessarily the best people to police big tech? The answer, I would suggest, is fairly obvious. And if you look at the Irish data protection authorities funds, which are roughly 17 million for this year, and you consider who they have to regulate, that gives you an idea of the potential scale of the problem. Now, having said all that, there are a lot of prospective decisions that are going to be coming out from Ireland over the next few months, and I'd encourage everyone to keep a weather eye out for them, because they include a statutory inquiry into Google's processing of location data, a statutory inquiry into Google's use of personalised online advertising, and a statutory inquiry into WhatsApp's sharing of personal data with the parent company Facebook. So, really important stuff. And if I were giving this talk in 6 months' time, there might be a different story to tell. With all this activity in one country in particular, and the pressure on that country's supervisory authority with policing big tech, that raises the issue of whether national regulatory authorities can bypass the one-stop-shop mechanism in Article 56 of the GDPR, and if so, under what conditions? And you'll recall that last January, CNIL levied a fine of 50 million euros on Google concerning its use of personalised ads, despite the fact that Google's EU headquarters is in Dublin. But what CNIL said is, well, that establishment didn't have any decision-making powers over the processing operations in question. Those were run from California by Google LLC. So we, CNIL, are competent to take any decision regarding this particular form of processing. Google has appealed that. The appeal's running through the French courts. There's no decision yet. What I think is perhaps interesting is that this fine has not been the prompt for other bypassing of the one-stop shop. And on the whole, where other national regulators have had complaints about big tech, and I'm thinking, for instance, of the Swedish and Dutch authorities regarding Google and Microsoft specifically, those have indeed been passed on to the Irish regulator as Articles 56 to 62 of the GDPR envisage is going to be the case. Another way of getting around the one-stop shop would be acting in a case of urgency. So Article 66 of the GDPR, and that contains an urgency procedure which permits derogation from the one-stop shop mechanism where urgency is needed in order to protect the rights and freedoms of data subjects. But it's limited to measures within the member state in question and measures that only last for up to 3 months. Now, that has been used. It's been used in Germany by the Hamburg Data Protection Commissioner, who opened administrative proceedings against Google concerning its use of speech assistance systems. Basically, employers of Google were listening to live conversations in order to test the correct operation of their home speech assistant tool. And the procedure was halted pretty quickly after Google agreed to change its practices. So what this illustrates, perhaps, is that even though on its face the urgency procedure has the limits that I've set out, it may well mean that whoever is being proceeded against changes their processes in ways that are going to have wider implications across the EU and indeed more generally. So may well be an effective way of proceeding. There's been some question about who is the lead authority if a controller moves under the one-stop shop mechanism. And all I wanted to note on that is that there's been a fairly recent opinion from the EDPB that contains detailed guidance on this, but the bull point is that essentially competence moves from the old supervisory authority to the new supervisory authority without invalidating anything that has already taken place. Post-Brexit, of course, the Information Commission is no longer going to be part of the EU enforcement mechanism, so the one-stop shop issues are not going to rise in the UK because the UK is going to be responsible for dealing with its own breaches within its jurisdiction. So that's the first topic. The next thing that I wanted to cover is the right to be forgotten. And shortly before Christmas last year, the CJEU moved into hyperactive mode, issuing three important decisions within a couple of weeks of each other, two of them Grand Chamber decisions, those being Google against Kinnear, GC against Kinnear, and the Glavishnik-Pishek case. And apologies to any Austrians for my pronunciation of Austrian politicians. And let me start with Google and Kinnear. And this concerns the important question of how the right to be forgotten applies territorially. And that's a question not only of what search results the search engine operator is obliged to remove. So do you just, if the complaint is in the UK, do you remove .uk results? Do you remove results within the EU for all domain names, or do you remove results worldwide? But also, in what territories search results must be invisible. So if someone's searching in the UK, must the .com results be removed for their search? And Kinnear said, dereferencing, the right to be forgotten, has to be universal. Otherwise, it's just not going to be effective. But it lost that battle. The CJEU did not take that position. What it said is that there needs to be a harmonised position within the EU, but search engine operators don't have any obligation in EU law to carry out a dereferencing request on all the versions of their search engine. So you don't need to remove the .com results. And that result, I would suggest, reflects a balance of competing interests. Because too great an assumption of global reach on the part of the CJEU could send completely the wrong signal to states that deal with access to information in very different ways, particularly, for instance, states which censor the net. And that's reflected in what the Advocate General said. There is a danger that the union will prevent people in third countries from accessing information. If an authority within the union could order a global dereference, a fatal signal would be sent to third countries, which could also order a dereferencing under their own laws. There's a real risk, he said, of reducing freedom of expression to the lowest common denominator across Europe and the world. Now, the CJEU took that on board. And it also pointed out that the balance of competing rights and interests in accessing information might vary from one member state to another. So this is an area where cooperation between different supervisory authorities and the mechanisms for cooperation contained within the GDPR may be particularly important. And also, and importantly, it said this about search engine operators' duties. It said that the search engine operators got to try to ensure that if you're searching from within the EU, in effect, you can't see the .com results. They need to take measures, to quote, which have the effect of preventing, or at the very least, seriously discouraging internet users in the member states from gaining access to the links in question using a search conducted on the basis of the data subject's name. What does seriously discouraging mean? Well, as is its usual wont, you won't be surprised to hear that the CJEU didn't further expand upon that. But what it seems to suggest is that geo-blocking is at the very least permitted, if not actively required. And in practice, search engines have worked since 2014 to block access to delisted URLs via other country search domains when access from the country that requested delisting. So it may well be, you know, that the ultimate message is no change in that respect. There is a sting in the tail, which is paragraph 72 of the judgment, because that says national authorities can go further. EU law doesn't require worldwide dereferencing, but member states can choose to do it. And I think it's fair to say that there is a tension between what is said there and the judgment's own earlier emphasis on cooperation between different supervisory authorities, not to mention the difficulty in reconciling this approach with the aim of the GDPR to set common standards. It also, I would suggest, lays open the possibility of forum shopping. If you think you've got a member state where worldwide dereferencing is a real possibility or a practice. So that's Google against Kinnear. And the next case is GC. It's another important judgment of the Grand Chamber. And that's about how the right to be forgotten applies when you're dealing with special category data. So you'll see from my slide that the data under consideration there was data about sexual relationships or about religious views, political affiliation, and indeed a criminal conviction. And the issue is, how does a dereferencing request apply to this sort of data, which falls within Article 9 and Article 10 of the GDPR, and not just Article 6? And the first question is, does the search operator need to have a basis for processing within Articles 9 and 10? Well, unsurprisingly, and entirely in line with Google Spain, the answer is yes. But I would suggest it's not immediately easy to see what that would be for a search engine operator. And in fact, the way in which the judgment analyzes this is to look not at the search engine operator's position, but at the position of the person seeking information. And the judgment says the condition that would be relied upon to process data in these sort of cases is processing is necessary for reasons of substantial public interest. So Article 9.2g, and the substantial public interest are the interests of the freedom of users of the internet to receive information. And as the judgment points out, it's really rather difficult to see what other condition could realistically apply. Now, as I said, I think there's a certain logical awkwardness, to put it at its lowest, in that sort of analysis, because what's being relied upon are interests that are not the interests of the data controller, in this case, Google. And to that extent, the analysis is a bit different from Google Spain, where the court was looking at the legitimate interests criterion and talking about the legitimate interests of the search engine operator. But what it does mean is it puts in stark relief what is perhaps the real question in these cases, which is, how do you balance the rights of people to receive information, those being the reasons of substantial public interest that make disclosure necessary, against the rights of data subjects under Articles 7 and 8 of the EU Charter. So in essence, it's the sort of exercise that will be very familiar to media practitioners everywhere, of balancing Article 8 privacy rights against Article 10 freedom of information rights in a particular context. The judgment is fairly unprescriptive about what the particular considerations that apply to this context may be. One thing that it does say is that because this is data within Articles 9 and 10, the interference with the data subject's rights will be particularly serious. And for that reason, inclusion of the link must be, quote, strictly necessary for protecting the right to freedom of information. So it suggests that a higher standard of necessity is properly applied in this sort of context. But as to how it is to be applied, the judgment doesn't really have a great deal to say. I'm going to, if I may, just step over the Glavishnik-Pishek case just for reasons of time. It's there on the slides from slides 25 to 28. And just move on to my third topic, which is e-privacy. And the first question I've asked is, what has happened to the e-privacy regulation? Well, since I wrote these slides, there has been some further activity. The EU Council presidency, at the moment Croatia, has just published a revised draft. And the most significant change in the revised draft is the introduction of a legitimate interests ground for processing electronic communications metadata and for placing cookies or similar sort of technologies on end users' terminals. So those are significant changes that go quite a long way to meet concerns expressed by member states, and they're due to be discussed at meetings this month. But nevertheless, I think the overall conclusion at the bottom of the slide, which is, at least for the foreseeable future, PECA is going to continue to govern e-privacy breaches. We're not going to have an e-privacy regulation. That remains absolutely true. There's been a recent important decision of the CJEU in this area, which impacts upon some of these questions as to cookies. Planet 49, under Article 7 of the GDPR, as you'll all be very well aware, consent as a basis for processing means clear, explicit, active and informed consent. So no pretext boxes, silence not good enough, inactivity not good enough. And the CJEU has confirmed that exactly that same concept of consent also applies to the e-privacy directive. So continuing the alignment between the data protection directive and the e-privacy directive in this sphere into the GDPR. The e-privacy directive, Article 5.3, requires consent for the storage of cookies. And the result of the application of the GDPR definition of consent in Article 7 in Planet 49 was that the website lottery in that case had not complied with the directive because they hadn't obtained valid consent for the use of cookies. An important point is made by the court there, and that is that the active consent of the end user is required under the e-privacy directive, irrespective whether the information stored or accessed is personal data. In other words, it explains why every time one visits a website, you have those annoying pop-ups that ask for your consent. It doesn't really matter what the cookies that may be used are storing. Now, I've said, well, that diverges from the Commission's proposal for the privacy regulation. It actually now diverges from the current proposal put forward by the Croatian presidency. So I think all I can really say about that is watch this space. The next e-privacy issue that I wanted to address is the Advocate General's opinion in a case called Privacy International. Now, that's a very significant case for national authorities dealing with terrorism and other national security issues. And it's a case that results from the Investigatory Power Tribunal's reference following Privacy International's challenge to the use of bulk communications data by the UK's security and intelligence agencies. And the question was, does the EU law apply at all in this area, which is national security? That's the first question. And the second question is, if so, do any of the requirements in the Watson case apply to the provision of bulk communications data to one of the agencies? Watson, as you may recall, was about the unfortunately named DRIPA, the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act. And I'm sorry, there's a misprint in these slides. I say it's about the Data Retention Directive. It's about DRIPA. After the terrorism attacks in 2005 in London, what happened is the EU put the Data Retention Directive in place to make communication services providers keep information that could then be passed on to national authorities. The directive was declared invalid by the CJU in Digital Rights Ireland. DRIPA was put in place, and other national authorities put in place legislation to deal with the gap, as it were. And Watson was the case in which the gap was challenged. And it's a, I would suggest, thoroughly unsatisfactory judgment. But a couple of the things that the CJU had said in Watson is access to data in the context of crime. So if your police service wanting to access communications data retained by a communication services provider, you can only get it for the objective of fighting serious crime. You can only get it if you're looking at the data of individuals suspected of being involved in that crime. And access needs to be subject to prior review by a court or other independent body. And that's why in the UK, for instance, the Office of the Communications Data Authorisation has been set up. But how does that apply in the national security sphere? Because in the national security sphere, the whole point about the use of bulk data is that the agencies are using it to search for, if I can paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, unknown unknowns. You are looking at seed data, you're trying to enrich it, you're looking at tiny pieces of information that you can put together with other pieces of information which will enable you to find out where the next threat is coming from. So it might be said, how can that possibly relate to suspicion about any given individual at the point that you are first looking at these microscopic bits of data? Well, that's certainly what the Investigatory Powers Tribunal thought after listening to the evidence over 5 days. It said, the National Court has found the imposition of the requirements specified in Watson, if applicable, would frustrate the measures taken to safeguard national security by the SIAs and thereby put the national security of the United Kingdom at risk. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, CJU. Well, the Advocate General has come back and effectively utterly ignored those clearly expressed concerns from the National Court. And what the Advocate General has said is, well, even if what is done for national security within the agencies themselves is outside the scope of EU law, a requirement imposed on communication services providers to retain data in order that it can then be requested is covered by EU law. And the Watson requirements do apply to that, and they do apply to requests for access to it. So, for example, access should be, the Advocate General says, only to the data of persons suspected of planning or being about to commit, of having committed or being involved in acts of terrorism. And also you've got to have a method of prior authorization, prior independent authorization, so the equivalent of OCTA. It might be said that that was an unacceptable failure to grapple with the practical implications of this sort of test within the sphere of national security, which could put the safety of the public at risk. But we'll just have to see how the CJU chooses to deal with that. And finally, and I'm sorry I'll have to cover this a little bit quicker than I would like, finally, Schrems II. The opinion of the Advocate General in Schrems II is delivered on the 19th of December. And as you'll be aware, this is a really important case on the validity of stranded contractual clauses for data transfers between the EU and the US. And Mr. Schrems not only challenges standard contractual clauses, so one mechanism for data transfer, but also requests that the EU-US privacy shield, so the other transfer mechanism, be declared invalid. And the Advocate General's opinion is a bit of a mixed bag from that point of view. And it's really based upon the nature of standard contractual clauses, because standard contractual clauses place the onus on the exporter of data or member state national authorities to suspend or prohibit transfers where a third country doesn't provide adequate protection. And Mr. Schrems said, well, that's not good enough. You've got to look at what's happening in the third country. And by the way, US doesn't provide adequate protection for data rights. And the Advocate General disagreed. And he says essentially that the validity of standard contractual clauses doesn't depend upon the nature of data rights in the third country, because it's all down to what data exporters or what national authorities do if it's found that privacy rights in the third country are not sufficiently protected. So, you know, all good news for data transfers until one gets to what is a massive sting in the tail. What's underlying all this is it's up to you, data exporters, member states, to prevent or suspend transfers if necessary. But by the way, says the Advocate General, albeit he says it's all obiter because I don't need to decide about the validity of the privacy shield. By the way, US privacy protections are thoroughly inadequate. So the Advocate General then goes on to put the boot in and say to national authorities, over to you. And having a look at what he says about privacy protections, he is very dismissive about how they operate in the case of data that is required for national security purposes by the NSA, because the authorities for the NSA's collection are basically twofold. It's Section 702 of FISA, Foreign Intelligence Services Act, or it is the Executive Order 12333. And the Advocate General says, well, I don't think the Executive Order has the quality of law at all, and then says that Section 702 of FISA isn't sufficiently precise to be in accordance with the law either. And moreover, and for good measure, the ombudsman mechanism in the Privacy Shield doesn't provide an effective remedy before an independent body. So all this is, I would suggest, pretty concerning going down the track. And we'll have to see what the CJU makes of it and whether it chooses to reiterate those sort of concerns that the Advocate General has expressed about the Privacy Shield. Now, the final topic that I was going to deal with is video surveillance and facial recognition. Actually, a really interesting topic, but I'm afraid I don't have time to deal with it. And